Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program where we sit down and talk about what's really going on in the lives of teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. We offer a thoughtful forum for discussion, bringing together diverse voices, informed perspectives, and meaningful dialogue. I welcome the Gen Z Lens team of students from the Clay School, bringing today's toughest conversations into sharper focus. From the pressures facing teens to the evolving role of families and educators, and to the choices shaping a new generation. Gen Z Lens doesn't just ask what's happening, it asks why it matters. Today, we step into one of the most politically charged conversations in America today, one that raises difficult questions about power, justice, loyalty, accountability, and the future of democracy itself. When does accountability become political revenge? Can Americans still trust institutions? And what happens when loyalty to political leaders collides with loyalty to democratic principles? I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield. Joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome the Gen Z Lens team. Let me ask you to introduce yourself, starting with the student producers. Arnav?
Hi, my name's Arnav. I just finished my freshman year at McClay. Happy summer, everybody. And I play the viola and I like to play tennis.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Simon and I play tennis and guitar and I also just finished my freshman year.
Okay. Hi, I'm Emery. I also finished my freshman year and I play piano and I'm on the newspaper.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sophia, and I also just finished my freshman year today, and I also play tennis, and I play piano, too.
Well, welcome to 411 Teen. I'm always glad to have you, hear your perspectives, get your take. At the center of today's discussion are questions far bigger than one individual or one political party. What happens when Americans lose trust in institutions? How much power should the president have? What responsibilities come with leadership? And what role do young people play in defending democratic values during moments of deep national division? My student producers, what was it about the IRS settlement controversy that prompted today's discussion? Because I know you immediately sent a quick text to me saying, we need to talk, okay? So would you share just kind of what brought us here while we're here?
So for me, I think that why I wanted to talk about this topic is the context of this year and what it means. It really sums up all that this administration has done, finding loopholes and leaving the boundaries of what they're allowed to do. And I also found it very ironic that it's a lawsuit by the government towards the government, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, other comments?
I think that it's, from the looks of it, the intention that they're trying to give isn't bad, right? Because they do say that this fund is made for anyone, regardless of party, who's been mistreated by the government. And that's not just tax related, as like with like the lawsuit between Trump and the IRS, but it's like just any type of mistreatment, like, you know, mm-hmm. wrong investigations, stuff like that. But I think something that really makes this whole settlement weird, especially with this fund, is actually in the statement released by the Office of the Attorney General. I have it pulled up. It says once the funds are deposited into the designated account, meaning the account that's going to manage all these funds, the $1.7 billion. Once the funds are deposited into the designated account, the United States has no liability whatsoever for the protection or safeguarding of these funds, regardless of their bank failure, of fraudulent transfers, or any other fraud or misuse of the funds. This is straight from the Office of Attorney General, and it's on the Department of Justice's website. So I feel like just that kind of sums up why people are feeling that there's some kind of there's malicious intent behind this.
Additional positions, additional comments? Anybody else want to comment on this controversy? Because we're just going to get into looking at, the values and the principles and what is going on. Okay, well, we can move on. Let me ask you, my first question here really is, do you think a democracy can survive if large populations stop trusting the courts, or they stop trusting elections, our law enforcement, our media? What happens if you have the populace losing trust in any of these institutions? How can democracy continue if you don't trust what the information you're getting?
I think that it's hard for it to continue, and I think the base of democracy is factual information, and without it, I don't think I think it's much harder for democracy to exist.
I also believe if people don't feel like they can communicate with their government. I mean, it goes back to even back when we were still colonizing with the British, if no taxation without representation. If people don't feel comfortable enough and don't trust their government well enough, their ideas can't be shared properly, and therefore the execution cannot occur of what the people really want. So I feel like if there's a distrust between that, it can undermine the purpose that the government, what they're supposed to do, what their responsibility is to the people.
All right. Other comments? I need to hear you. What do you think? Now we'll move on. Well, do you feel like there's a difference between accountability and political revenge? And who gets to define that difference?
There should be a difference between accountability and political revenge, obviously. But it's the way that, especially I'd say in this administration, and it's not just I think it's obviously in politics that has always been a problem. Like accountability, is it accountability or is it political revenge? But I think there should definitely be a fine line between it. Just and the problem with regulating something about that is that political revenge will cut. I think a lot of the times you could think that it would come after a new leader, whatever, gets elected, and they change the rules to make it affect other people, either in, it can help their people in good ways or people of a different party in bad ways, right? So obviously that's why it's kind of hard to know who actually gets to make that change because of the fact that they're always, when new leaders get elected, they can just change the rules back to what they were before or to what they prefer.
Yeah, that's a good point. How do we address that, though? I mean, when the ruling party is in, they're going to push their agenda. And it doesn't matter, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it does not matter there, because you see it in both parties. So I'm not, looking at one or the other, but how do we get to a point where there is some consistency? Or do we get there? Do we want to get there?
Sorry. I think the US tries to kind of balance this with the checks and balances system, like the three different parts of government. You have, you know, the executive, you have the judicial, right? And because of this, usually I think it like helps just make sure that there's not complete like power distributed to like one side only. And usually this is the way that works, but I'd say, especially in this administration, I see our president using a lot more, instead of going through the Senate and the House of Representatives to pass like laws, he's just writing executive orders, which can be repealed later, but for the time being, they do have legal effect. And that's what, and on top of that, when they do go to pass laws, as of right now, the majority of all three branches are Republican. So that's kind of why, as of right now, the system that was put in place for this isn't really working.
Well, yeah, okay, go ahead.
I agree 100% with Arnav, especially today. It's hard for checks and balances to work. And without checks and balances, there's nothing holding back the president from doing whatever he wants.
Okay.
Yes, I agree. I think it's very important for everyone to be accountable. And yeah, if all three branches, they all have a certain, outweighing a certain side. So it's definitely hard to keep everyone accountable that way, but making sure that, or trying to move towards more equal access, like amongst those branches, and just equal chance to have a common goal and everyone be able to have equal input.
Okay. Should taxpayers ever fund compensation? Do you feel like the taxpayers should fund the compensation for people who claim they are politically targeted by the government? And if you claim you're politically targeted by the government, who determines that? You might say you have been, you know, targeted. Someone else may say no. I mean, I don't see how we can make this fair and just. That's where I sit, and that's why I asked that. I mean, I just don't understand it. But you all can tell me. But we're going to take a break. We're at that point. You tuned in to 411 Team. We'll get right back at you. You're listening to 411 Team. Gen Z Lens team is exploring power, presidential authority, political accountability, and the growing debate over whether American institutions are protecting democracy or becoming tools in political welfare. Before we went on break, I just mentioned to you, do you feel like the taxpayers should fund this compensation for people who claim they have been politically targeted? And how do we determine if they have been targeted?
So what I was kind of saying before was that the whole idea of this fund wasn't, I don't think, it's a little bit iffy, but I don't think the whole idea of it, just on like a sheet of paper, I don't think that sounded bad, like taxpayers paying for paying somebody if you know they were politically targeted wrongly, just you know, off of like their political beliefs, right? And I think the problem with this, and that's the reason why there's so much outrage over it, is because it's being controlled by Trump. And I think one thing in specific is that I think what you mentioned was that you were asking, you know, who gets to decide who has been politically targeted. And something about this fund is that it's not, you know, official yet, but I think what was proposed was that the people in charge of this wouldn't be like a panel of judges, but it would instead be a panel of people appointed by the Trump administration. So in other words, people that Trump is choosing, And that definitely makes it more biased.
I was just getting ready to say, here we go, you know?
Yeah, I agree with what Arnolf said. On paper, it's not that bad because, like, during the Obama administration, there was another fund. I think it was towards people who have been, like, racially discriminated or something. But the difference, the main difference that I see from back then to now is that back then the funds were allocated and given to people by bipartisan committees. So it wasn't just the president and it wasn't just one party. Whereas today it stemmed out of a lawsuit that Trump created against his own government, and the committee that's going to allocate the funds is going to be chosen by Trump. And I think that this makes it so that one party has all of the power with this fund, and so it's not fair.
Okay.
So one thing I've noticed is that we all agree that so far that of everyone that has spoken is that we all agree that the fund's purpose seems to be well, like it's meant to help the people. And I believe that the fund is meant to show, back to what you said earlier, accountability. So it's like the way I view accountability is to maintain public trust and ensure no one is above the law. And I feel the purpose of this fund is to show that no one is above the law, even the law itself, to show that they're taking accountability for their previous actions.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with Sophia, but it's just scary to think about what could be done with this fund since one party is in charge of it and it's targeted towards, I mean, I've heard like examples, like the funds might be allocated to like the January 6th rioters, and anything could happen. And that's, I think, what's scary about this.
Yeah.
I think the scary part is the fact that the eligibility standards are just unclear for everyone. And I feel like with clarification, people could see the different ways that like this fund could be beneficial. But without it, I feel it causes this controversy that we're discussing right now.
Yeah.
I think this fund can be very beneficial, like if it is executed the right way. Like, yes, we've all said, I think it has good intentions, or I mean, that's the way it's presented. It's,
well, we know about good intentions now. Okay.
I think it's being presented as kind of something that is trying to get both sides involved, but I don't know the degree to which it will be executed that way, which can get a little into like the gray area of whether or not it's doing that.
Well, you all have raised some real valid points. Let me add this to it. If a president believes institutions treated him unfairly, should he have the power to restructure those institutions?
I don't think that he should have the power to do this because it ruins the point of the democracy that we have in this country where the people are in power and not the president. The president is executing the people's wish. But when he feels like checks and balances have been used on him and he overrides the checks and balances, I think it can be very dangerous and it's not good.
Yeah, I agree. 'Cause if a president feels that way and just then goes in and changes things to, you know, a way where he doesn't feel that way, then there's just like there's not necessarily a point where it will stop. So it could just, you know, keep going and there's no line, you know, to be drawn. So that definitely can get a dangerous thing to be doing even if it's a small thing. Once it can be like excused if people think that way, but over time it's just like when would it stop?
Well, how do you handle it even if it is a line that's drawn? there've been situations where lines have been drawn, but it doesn't matter if you just step over that line and keep on going.
Yes, that's definitely also something that takes away from a democracy and the position of the president being there to advocate for the people.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think this has been like in so many issues these past few years when this administration was in power, like the war in Iran, there was nothing to stop the president from doing what he wished because he did not seek congressional approval and no one was there to stop him. And I think it's the same in this situation. There's nothing in place to monitor what he's doing and to keep him in check.
Are Americans, do you feel like Americans are becoming more loyal to political figures than to the democratic institution itself?
Yeah, I think that people are becoming more loyal to one party and not the democratic institution because the world and these issues are becoming more and more polarized and the sides are so like different and like the extremes are so far apart that there is not really a middle ground for many people and it's hard to stick by the principles of democracy and not like stick to only one side.
Okay. Well, do you feel like loyalty, and I think you hinted or alluded to this, but do you feel like loyalty, is it important? Is it an important quality in government leadership? Or does it become dangerous in a democracy? You know, do we govern by loyalty? Is that what the leadership is about?
So being loyal to your own party isn't necessarily dangerous in itself. Okay. But what I've seen throughout this party is that everybody in the House, everybody in Senate, all of Trump's appointed Supreme Court justices, they all don't are like, you know, scared to say something. They all don't want to say something. I mean, I'm not saying some of them don't agree with his opinion, but pretty much every one of them will vote yes to anything that he asks to pass. And
well, he also threatens them and tells them, if you don't, you will be looking for a new job.
And actually, very recently, that is something that happened. Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky did not, he's a Republican, but he didn't agree with what Trump was saying. And so they actually, and just, it was just one congressional district in, you know, rural Kentucky, right? Nice. And, you know, they poured $30 million into his primarial opponent. Just so he wouldn't be going back. And I feel like that really shows that loyalty itself isn't like bad, but when it's taken too far, it's at that point not looking out for like the American people or even the people of the district that they're representing, but more just their leader or their president.
The same thing happened with Jerome Powell. Trump asked him to do something and he didn't do it. And so now he's gone. And I think that's very scary for many people. And the level of loyalty to this one person in a certain party has gone in like so high that no one wants to break their loyalty to them, even if they disagree with him on an issue.
Yeah, I think loyalty obviously can be beneficial and have problems within like political parties, but when it gets to a point where it's like it's almost forced because it's not I think people feel like they may not have other options, and at that point I'm not sure if it's even loyalty, but it's just this, it's an abuse of power, kind of, and mm-hmm. put on people to have really no other choice.
Well, what message does a president send when rewarding political allies?
It shows that there is no one to check him or to contradict him in his own party. There's no one to doubt his actions. And it shows there's nothing to stop him in his own party. Like, he could do whatever he wants, and his party will go along with it because they know that he gives them things in exchange for their loyalty to him. Mm-hmm. I think that's dangerous, too.
Well, in looking at pardons and rewarding political allies, how should presidents use pardons? Should they be primarily for mercy or for correcting injustice or protecting political movements? How do you feel a pardon should be used?
I think the way it was intended to be used was for correcting injustice.
Okay.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, not to reward someone for doing something, or it's not a method of rewarding anyone. It's a method to correct wrongs.
But because there's no checks at all in the pardon system, because it's, you know, something very simple, right? It's just like, oh, if you're the president and you think that somebody who's committed a federal crime shouldn't be in prison, you know, you can just say you don't have to be in prison anymore. It's something that's supposed to be really simple, but in reality, because there's like no checks on it, it's being used for it's being used for political reasons. It's like not really as much for just plain injustice anymore.
Well, okay. Where should the limit of executive power be? And with the executive power, we're talking about, you know, presidential power. Where should the limits be? I mean, if one administration, I'm thinking, expands presidential authority, then what prevents the next and future administrations from pushing those limits even further? I mean, how do we check this? What do we do? I mean, because you all are going to have to deal with this. You know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
you know?
It's a very complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only thing that's in the way of a president or a government, it's really the fundamental constitution and the powers that were allocated to branches of government at the beginning of America. And I think people will see if power is abused so much, people will see this and I think combat this and try to restore a balance between different branches of power and not having one sole leader.
Okay.
In like the 300 years of our country, not once have we had a sole leader who didn't have anyone to stop him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that kind of ties back to like the whole point that like our government is a democracy. I mean, it's a fundamental point. And I believe that's like something that like with an abuse of power, we suddenly lack. And in that, I believe, like, our country lacks fundamental values. And then with that, the issues then just can consistently occur more and more, leading to, like, where we are now, debating issues based on views that are coming from opposing sides that never should have been there to begin with this complete and total non-bipartisanship.
Well, we have so much political polarization. Do you think that this political polarization makes Americans more willing to excuse behavior from the leaders that they support. Is that what's going on?
I think that people are given no other choice than to excuse the actions because of this polarization of political issues, because people are pushed to such extremes of a party that they don't have any other choice but to support mm-hmm. every action that the leader of their party does.
What do you think of that? If we're pushing them to the point that they don't have any options, they have to either go along with it.
I think we just have to wait till the next election, the midterm election, to see how people vote, how they respond to this abuse of power. And if for some reason the elections are stolen or rigged because mm-hmm. this one person abused their power so much, then I think people will rise up against it. And I think something will change this midterm or the next presidential election. I don't think it'll go on for much longer, this abuse of power.
Okay. Other comments? Well, you're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program exploring issues and confronting young people, families, educators, and communities. And this is the Gen Z Lens. Today, we are just looking at what's happening at the presidential level as far as authority and accountability, and just debating how we go. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and today we have the Gen Z Lens team. And my next question to you is, at what point does strong leadership become authoritarianism?
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah. What point does strong leadership become authoritarianism?
I think it becomes authoritarianism mm-hmm. where there is no more opposition within a party in power. Because when there's no more people speaking out against the leader of their political party, and the people who have the power, like in Congress, so like currently the Republicans who have the majority, when there's no one left to speak up against their president, I think that's when it becomes authoritarianism. And when people are too scared to speak out against their own party, because we know like the Democrats mm-hmm, mm-hmm. will almost always speak up against these issues, but they don't have much power because they're not really in charge. And yeah.
Okay. Other comments? I'd like to hear where everybody sits on this, you know? Because if you have a strong, strong leadership, and it's so strong that people are afraid to oppose it, does that make it? Where are we? What does that say? What message does that send?
I agree with what Simon said, and just if no one can speak up, then that's just that's disregarding the whole purpose. And even when, like within a party, even if one party is the entire majority, even if people in that party can't even speak up because they're all, varying views mm-hmm. even within a party. So even if that people there don't feel comfortable or can't speak up, then at that point I think it's really lost, because people can't share, and that's really important to, again, the democracy and mm-hmm. just
okay all the
You
time.
said the difference between strong leadership and authoritarianism, you said?
Yeah.
So, like, the way I view strong leadership versus, like, authoritarianism? Wow, I think I might have butchered saying that one. But okay. An autocratic
we know
form
where,
of
we
government.
We know where you're coming from.
You see where I'm coming from with this one. So, strong leadership, it inspires people. It empowers a team of people toward a shared vision, balancing it with, like, collaboration. But meanwhile, I'm just going to say an autocratic form, like, demands blind obedience and, like, focuses all power onto one topic through compliance, through fear, rigid control. And I feel like once you get past the point where, like, it is simply leadership and suddenly you're controlling what people are doing or speaking, whether their opinions are heard and making them seem invalid, I believe that causes dissension between people and therefore hurts the general population and the public as a whole. Because if people aren't able to speak what they're saying or their views aren't seen by the people because of an autocratic form of government, it defeats the whole point of having us, of having all these strong leaders we've elected who we've put time and effort into helping get to where they are. And suddenly we're undermining that. I feel like that causes large issues for people.
Okay. And when we look at how should a nation respond? If a nation responds with political protests and that turns into violence, how do we handle that? What responsibility do political leaders bear for the action of their supporters? That's a better way. What's their responsibility?
So when it comes to political leaders bearing a responsibility for their voters, their supporters' actions, if it's something that was brought up through the supporters themselves, and I think usually when this happens, it's like a very extreme group of people who are supporting like the most extreme values of not just like one person, but more like of an idea. And obviously then I don't think that you can blame the leader itself, though. If the leader is promoting violence, promoting rioting, and obviously promoting like a peaceful protest isn't the same as promoting violence. There's two differences in that. But if a leader is promoting violence, then of course they should be held accountable for their actions, because that's never okay. And it, obviously, if it's specifically meant to be a peaceful protest, but it spirals out, I think they should still have at least a little bit of accountability for it, because part of their job as the person who not organized it but is promoting the idea, it's part of it is just to make sure that people remain safe. So it's there's definitely a lot of accountability that should go in the leader or whoever's hands before anything happens.
And I don't think we saw this during the exact situation that you're talking about is like January 6th.
Exactly.
Where the president told his supporters to go overturn an election. They were confirming the results of his election that he lost. And when you encourage your voters, like blatantly encourage them to violently riot at the Capitol, the like center of democracy, I think he needed to be held accountable, and he didn't. And I think that's another like form of how he abused his power, and how not much opposition within his own party was there. And the opposition that was, they were like silenced. Like Mike Pence, for example, he lost all power because he opposed it. And I think, yeah.
Okay. And you raised a good point there, which led me to another question. Can pardoning the individuals that were connected to January 6th, can that be viewed as reconciliation, or does it risk normalizing political violence?
It definitely, maybe not risks normalizing it, but definitely puts a bad precedent on that, saying, not saying that if anyone commits a political related crime, as long as it's in your favor, he's just gonna pardon you. But more like it's giving like the precedent that he can do whatever he wants, or like the leader just in general, you know, not just based off of January 6th, but I know that's what we're talking about mainly here. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, the leader can do whatever he wants to pardon people who he thinks are unjustly jailed, mm-hmm. even if it's not a just reason. And that definitely makes it, that definitely isn't a good thing, because of the fact that people feel like they can, if people feel that if he says so, if, you know, let's just say Trump, if Trump says so, then it's all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the craziest part of all of this is that not only did the people who incited this January 6th and the people who were involved in January 6th, they weren't held accountable, but now they might be rewarded for what they did with taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
Like, there's the risk of that mm-hmm. happening.
Well, do you feel Americans are learning different versions of history depending upon the media? You know, the media that they consume. I mean, what do you listen to? Do you think that is really influencing their version of history?
Oh yeah. It's like a different media sources have always mm-hmm. been like, there's all like a ton of the media sources. There's like many sources that will be aligned to the right. There's many that'll be aligned to the left, and both of which, obviously freedom of press is a thing. They will tell stories in, you know, their own perspective on their own agenda. Mm-hmm. And that's always been a fundamental right of the media in the Constitution. So,
okay. But how has social media changed the way young people understand the truth and credibility?
I think that before social media, news outlets or that were credible, even if they were biased towards a political side, the credible ones had to report the facts, and that's how they gained their credibility. But okay. when you go into social media, people believe everything that they see, and there's no more obligation to report the facts, and it can like turn into like complete opinions not based off of facts. And especially like with the introduction of AI, mm-hmm. people can create like videos and images that never happened. And I think that contributes to misinformation too.
Where do you get your information from? All of you. Yeah, you don't have to elaborate. I mean, just where do you get it from? If you want to check something out, where do you go?
I like to go to NPR or some non-politically biased news sources, like Politico is one, or also I like to use international sources. So like in France, I like to use Le Monde, mm-hmm. because they report on American issues, but they don't have a stake at the issues. And so they tend to like speak more about the facts. Yeah,
I kind of definitely look for things that are bipartisan and sources like that. But also there are, like we've established, there are media platforms that are very, you know, that go very far to each side. So sometimes I kind of like to look at both, like the way they dress the same event or whatever, and kind of just see the difference and kind of pick up on both sides and what's being said. I think that's kind of, it's pretty interesting when you can see the different, both different things.
I'm completely with Emery on that. I love to see like side by side, like comparisons of like the same ideas, because in that you can see that people are really thinking about all of like all these issues, and understanding different points of view, I feel like leads to such a deeper understanding of the topic at hand. Like, of course, I'll go to like PBS News or like how Simon said earlier, NPR, for like unbiased facts. But I also feel like bias helps show the importance of these issues and shows how these can be viewed from different sides and possible ways that we can compromise if the values align. And in that, I believe there's tons of value.
Okay.
Yeah, I think see all of the sides that you can take, all the views that there are, opinions about facts, it allows people the opportunity to take an opinion, a side that they believe in based off of the facts. And if they look at only like one politically biased news source, then they're going to take the opinion of that source. Whereas if they look at like multiple from like different sides, then they're giving the opportunity to like choose what they think is right.
Okay. Well, then how do we protect free speech while confronting misinformation?
I think that's such a hard question. Because
I mean, you all made me think about it. As we were talking, I was like, well, you're right. But then what do we do? How do we protect, you know, free speech? But we, you know, we got to confront this misinformation. What do we do?
Think restrictions on social media posts and like accounts, and I don't know, it's such a complicated issue because there's so many people on social media posting like misinformation and lies that it's kind of hard to control them. But I think it stems on like, I think personally that social media, like the owners of the platforms should themselves like restrict political content on social media because it polarizes people and it can also feed people lies. And I think banning politics on social media will like drive people to go onto like trusted news sources, and I think that would be better.
I think something that kind of adds to the toughness in trying to get uncredible news off but making sure everybody's voice is heard on social media, is that the thing with social media algorithms is that I think some of them can try and limit the amount of misinformation. But at the same time, in doing this, they might accidentally block out some minority opinions. And that's a real issue because in that case, you have either two sides where one, everybody's, you know, opinion is shared equally, or two, you have some people's it's mostly, you know, trying to restrict misinformation, but in the process of doing so, it restricts some people's opinion. And that is a big issue with algorithms, like, you know, political ideologies in social media algorithms.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the line between like a fact or an opinion is just like, it's almost impossible because like to say only, you know, fact might like, I kind of, you know, that might kind of sounded simple at first as like a way to, you know, make sure the media is like, at least on social media, having not giving like providing misinformation, but also beyond, like there's so much more beyond that because within like fact, people can interpret things in so many different ways. So at some point that is an opinion. So I think it's very hard to have like a fine rule?
Well, basically it's time out. But you all have really dealt with some difficult questions, okay? And one thing is certain, the future of democracy will not be shaped by presidents or courts or political parties. It will be shaped by young people willing to think critically, engage responsibly, and participate courageously. Democracy is something every generation must decide whether to strengthen, weaken, or defend. Thank you, Gen Z Lens, and my listening audience. I always thank you for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in to 411 Teen next week, same time, same place. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at WFSU.org.